best we can do, isn't it, in the circumstances. And thanks be to God, we can actually keep our meetings going in this way. Well, in the last few days, weeks perhaps, we've been watching on the news the effects of what's happening in Belarus. Remember, in Belarus, the president there has been there in office for something like 26 years, actually since the time when they broke away from the Soviet Union. But people have grown tired with his rule, suspecting him of being fraudulent and not being a good leader. And so there have been lots of demonstrations in the streets of Belarus to try and get rid of the president. So there is an embryo revolution. They want to overthrow the one who's been in office for a long time and set up a different regime. Well, you know, that's not terribly different to what we were reading about in our first Bible reading this morning. So let's go back to the 2nd of Kings, chapter 11, and we'll read about another revolution a long time ago. But it's got some very useful, important lessons for us in these last days. So you remember in our readings recently, King Ahab of Israel imported trouble into his country by marrying Jezebel, the daughter of Ethbaal, the king of the Zidonians. And she imported into Israel the worship of Baal and Asherah, these heathen gods. And they were immoral deities. They had no morality about them at all. So she encouraged people to worship Baal, to commit adultery in the worship of Baal. You see that from the book of Revelation, where it mentions this. And you can see this woman, Jezebel, had no restraint at all about her own conscience, really, about what she did, because she actually slew innocent Naboth and his sons in order to let her husband take over the vineyard. Do you remember that story we read a few days ago? Well, what we're reading about now is the next generation, because her daughter, Athaliah, married the son of the king of Israel, Jehoshaphat. And so our attention now moves from the 10-tribe kingdom, Ahab and Jezebel, to the kingdom of Judah, the southern kingdom, in chapter 11 that we're reading now, where Athaliah, the daughter of Jezebel, carries on with the same kind of cruelty as her mother did, Jezebel. Because as we read in chapter 11, verse 1, when her son was dead, he'd been killed by Jehu, she arose and destroyed all the seed royal. Seed royal means the sons of the king, of course, so that they could not inherit the kingdom because they were dead. But they were her own grandsons. So this evil woman actually was determined to wipe out her own family, her own grandsons, in order that she could be the queen. That's what she became. She took the throne. And it would have been a very near thing, really, because God had promised to King David that, and we're talking about Judah now, God had promised to King David that there would always be somebody sitting on his throne. So if she had wiped out all the sons of Ahaziah, that would have broken the chain of descent for the Messiah, for Jesus himself, coming down from King David. And she, being the queen, would have taken over. But God, in his wisdom, foresaw that might happen and forestalled it, as we saw in this fascinating way, because in verse 2, Jehosheba, the daughter of King Joram, sister of Ahaziah, took little Joash, the son of Ahaziah, stole him from among the king's sons that were slain, and hid him and his nurse in the bedchamber from Athaliah, so that he was not slain. So the youngest of the grandsons escaped the executioners because his aunt, she was actually his aunt, the sister of Ahaziah, took hold of him and hid him in a chamber in the bedroom so that he wasn't seen. He must have been quite small at this time because it says in verse 4, in the 70th year, Jehoiada sent and fetched the rulers. And in verse 21, Jehoiada was 7 years old when he began to reign. So he must have been a tiny baby, only perhaps a few days or months old, when he was saved by his auntie, Jehosheba. Now, in the parallel account in the book of Chronicles chapter 22, which tells the story from a different point of view of the kings of Judah, we have some interesting extra information there which might help to understand the story. 2 Chronicles, chapter 22, and verse 10, to link in with what we just read in Kings. Verse 10, when Athaliah saw that her son was dead, she arose and destroyed all the seed royal. And now verse 11, Jehoshiabeath, it's actually spelt slightly differently here to what it was in Kings, but it's the same person, Jehosheba, the daughter of the king. So she's actually Ahaziah's daughter, all her brothers have been killed, took Joash, the son of Ahaziah, and stole him from among the king's sons, it was saying, and put him in his nurse in a bedchamber. So Jehosheba, taking the name in Kings, the daughter of King Jehoram, that's not King Ahaziah, but the King Jehoram, the wife of Jehoiada the priest, hid him from Athaliah. So she's both the daughter of the King Jehoram, who's been killed by Jehu, and therefore the auntie of Joash. But she's also, we find in verse 11, the wife of Jehoiada the priest. Now, that's interesting. What do we know about Jehoiada? He must have been a very old man by the time we're studying, because in the Chronicles record, you'll find in chapter 24, verse 15, he dies at the age of 130 years old. That's only a few years after what we've been reading. So he must have been a very aged man by the time we're looking at, we're studying. And that means if he was 130 when he died, and you go backwards, Jehoiada must have been born in the reign of King David. That means this amazing man had lived all through the reign of Solomon. He watched the temple being built from scratch. He'd seen the division of the kingdom in Jeroboam and Rehoboam. He lived through the reigns of several kings afterwards. He survived Jehoshaphat's reign. And he would have followed the tragedy of Ahab's marriage to the northern kingdom. And we would have seen the error of Jehoshaphat in marrying his son to the daughter of Ahab. Now, at some point, it seems, Jehoiada himself had married the daughter of Ahaziah, the king who'd been shot. Jehoram, the king, had been shot dead by Jehu, the chariot driver. So perhaps she was his second wife, because she's obviously much younger than he was. But that means that this man Jehoiada, this priest Jehoiada, actually had a link himself with the royal family. He'd married into the royal family, the daughter of the king. So it's pretty clear that this man Jehoiada was quite an institution. Somehow he'd survived all that conflicts that had gone through all those years. And even though Athaliah had come to the throne, she wasn't able to get rid of Jehoiada because he was such an institution. And actually, she actually robbed the temple of the precious vessels that were used in the worship of God. It says that in 2 Chronicles 24. But even so, Jehoiada managed to keep going the courses of the priests that came and went each week on duty, as arranged by King Solomon, of course, years ago. So Jehoiada represents the old order. Somehow God had preserved his life for this awful time when the queen mother has destroyed all her grandsons and there's no king left on the throne, or wouldn't have been, apart from little Joash. So now Jehoiada and his wife Jehosheba take this enormous risk of hiding the prince royal in the temple, away from Athaliah. And because she herself didn't go into the temple, because she worshipped Baal and other things, she didn't find out. But if word had got out that the true heir to the throne was still alive, no doubt Jehoiada and his wife would have been put to death. So, going back to our chapter in Kings, 2 Kings 11, verse 3 now, we see this young baby hidden in the temple reaches the age of 7, unharmed. Nobody knew of his existence except Jehoiada, Jehosheba, and the child's nurse. And by now, the boy could obviously read and write, and he'd be given some training, no doubt, in the duties and customs of a king. That's Jehoiada's intention, to set him on the throne. Now Jehoiada sets in motion a very daring plan, a revolution, he was going to risk his neck even further than he had already by organising what we might call a coup d'etat, a stroke by which he would remove Atalaya from the throne and replace her with little Joash. Now first, as we read in the story here, he had to get on his side the commanders of the army. He needed to have the military arm behind him if the plot was to succeed. So we can see in verse 4, he sent and fetched the rulers over hundreds with the captains and the guards and brought them to the house of the Lord. So he invited the leaders of the army to come to him in the temple for some, presumably he must have explained the meeting to everybody else as being something to do with the temple. But at that time, he tells them his plan. And he makes a covenant with them, verse 4, and takes an oath of them in the house of the Lord that they will support him in replacing Atalaya on the throne with little Joash. It must have been pretty brave for these men to throw in their lot with Jehoiada at this time. You can draw a parallel perhaps with the Catholic gunpowder plot that we had here in England to try and remove King James I. That's what their plan was. And they agreed, didn't they, in secret, met together in secret with councils to plan what they were going to do, set up gunpowder and for all the Guy Fawkes to set it off. Same kind of idea, really, is that, in complete secrecy. So they swear to put Joash on the throne. Now, Jehoiada reveals to them his plan in verse 5. Before it happens, he's going to tell them what he's going to do. He's explaining his plan. Verse 5, he said, this is the thing we're going to do. When the Levites come in for duty on Sunday, or Saturday, sorry, Sabbath called, when they come out on duty on Saturday, for the next week, we'll hang on to the ones who should have gone home on Saturday because their week was finished. And that way we shall have two lots of Levites, all in the temple at the same time. And he says, we'll chop them into three parts, verse 5. One third of them will watch over the king's house, where Atalaya might suddenly emerge from, of course. And then one group would guard the main gate, that's the gate of Zur. Zur means foundation, it's the main gate of the temple. And the third group of them, one third, would watch round the house, the temple itself, the doors of the temple, so that they couldn't get it, nobody could get in without being seen. So, in verse 7, those who would have gone forth on the Sabbath stay behind and add themselves to the others to make a much bigger group of Levites. Now, they need weapons. And in verse 10, captains over the hundreds did the priests give King David spears and shields that were in the temple of the Lord. You might remember the temple actually was the armory for the whole country. It was a treasury for the whole country, Israel, the Bank of Israel. But it was also the armory. And all the weapons that were needed in a time of war were kept in the temple. Atalaya hadn't realized that. And that was a big thing. So now he could take those arms from the temple treasury and hand them over to the Levites and the army men with their men who turned up on duty according to their covenant, the promise they'd made. So they had to form a complete circle around little Joash to protect him. And in verse 11, they stood every man with his weapons round about the king from the right corner of the temple to the left corner of the temple, a complete circle round little King Joash. In verse 12, Jehoiada brings forth the king's son, Joash, and puts the crown upon him. You can imagine it must have been quite a big, heavy crown for little Joash, only 7 years old. You remember when our own queen was crowned in Westminster Abbey. She had to practice with that crown beforehand because it was very heavy. And this is only a little boy. So he's wearing the crown. And it says in verse 12, they gave him the testimony. That's probably a copy of the law. Every king had to have a copy of the law to copy out himself. So Jehoiada gives him an official copy of the law. That's interesting too, because those of you who are alive at the time may remember that our queen was given a copy of the law of the Bible at the time of her anointing. So it was handed to her to read. Okay, so Then they clap their hands in verse 12 and say, God save the king. It must have been quite scary for little Joash to be surrounded by such a multitude of people after those 7 years of complete isolation in the temple. But he acted his part, little part, bravely, didn't he? And they all clap their hands and say, God save the king. Of course, Athaliah hears that in verse 13, and she rushes into the temple courts and sees this coronation service going on and the young boy wearing the heavy crown, and she realizes her reign is over. Treason, treason, she cries, but within a few minutes, she's dragged outside the temple and put to death. Now, at that point, interesting, verse 17, with the revolution now over, the coup d'etat has succeeded, thanks be to God, he now makes a covenant, verse 17, between the Lord and the king and the people, that they should be the Lord's people, not Baal, whom Athaliah worshipped, but the Lord's people, and between the king and the people, that he would diligently serve the people himself. Again, reflections of that in the coronation service for Queen Elizabeth II. She promised to be faithful ruler of the people. So now, verse 18, they go into the house of Baal, just around the corner, and they break it down, kill the priests of Baal, and appoint officers over the house of the Lord. It's going back to its normal use as it had been before the time of Athaliah. And so the king sat on the throne, and all the people of the land rejoiced, verse 20, because the city was in quiet. Now, it's interesting, brothers and sisters, isn't it, that we always find that what God promises comes true. And even though at the time it looked as if they were going to be defeated because there wasn't going to be a king on the throne of David, he ensured that little Joash was kept alive to continue that line of descent down to King Jesus. I have to say, actually, when you look at the genealogy of Mary in Matthew chapter 1, it doesn't mention Joash. It jumps from Jehoram to Uzziah, his grandson. But little Joash must have been there, of course. But the survival of Joash to keep God's promise to David going depended on them taking an enormous risk. They risked their lives, brothers and sisters. Well, there are times in the service of God when we have to face danger. We even have to be prepared, don't we, to lay down our lives for the Lord Jesus. We're not called to be martyrs like the Muslim suicide bombers, but we have to be ready to try out a course of action where we cannot be sure of success or even safety, believing that God will be with us. That's the point, because that's what Jehoiada did. Think for a moment of Peter in the boat with the 11 other apostles. Peter was the only one who dared to step over the side of the boat and walk on the water to Jesus. He believed that he would be supported by the water because his master was. But the other 11 weren't prepared to leave the security of the boat. Although actually, when you think about it, it's only a piece of wood about that thick that surrounded them and kept them out of the water. So, like Peter, there are occasions in our lives when we have to step outside the boat and we have to take risks in our service of the Lord, like Jehoiada did. So, sometimes, for example, the CBM needs volunteers to go to Ukraine for the Bible school. Or our meeting decides to try out a new method of preaching because of the lockdown. We can't use our normal Bible talks anymore, so we have to do something different. Or we have to rearrange our Sunday services when we go back to our meeting hall after the COVID's all over. And there'll always be people who say, oh, it won't work, or oh, it's too dangerous. Or we always did it like this, don't change anything. But we have to be prepared, like Jehoiada, to try out something different and believe that God will guide and protect us and show us the right way. Think of the dangers the Apostle Paul faced to bring the gospel to the people he's writing to in Corinthians in our New Testament reading. He literally risked his life at the hands of his enemies, the Jews, and yet he believed he was doing God's work and that God would support him in what he was doing. And so it was with Jehoiada and Jehosheba, his wife. They believed they must keep the throne going in the line of David and restore the worship of the Lord after years of apostasy, Baal worship. And they pulled it off, as we've seen. Actually, it's interesting to see how their very names illustrate the work they were undertaking for God. Because Jehoiada means the God who knows. And Jehosheba means the God of the promise. And that's what they were upholding and keeping going. My brothers and sisters, we come here this morning to remember Jesus, the son of David, son of Joash, along my back. And he appeared in Israel in the time of great spiritual poverty. And he called on people to leave the security of their homes and families to follow him in a program of teaching that was quite revolutionary. It was a challenge. And if you followed him, he didn't promise you relief from taxes or better housing for the poor or a nice new motor car. Any benefits he might bring you would only come in the distant future in this kingdom he kept talking about. All he would promise was that if they did follow him, people would find that God would provide food and clothes. If they left everything to follow him, God would give them at least that, continue with life. And you remember, actually, there's an example of that, because Peter and the other 11 apostles were sent out by Jesus to test for themselves that God would be with them when they were preaching the good news of the kingdom. And Jesus made them leave their purses behind. Not even credit cards, they weren't to take anything. So, not even a spare coat in case it rained. They had to trust on this missionary journey, this trial, preaching mission. They had to trust that God would provide for them. And he did. And they came back rejoicing that the doors had been opened and the good news had been received with joy. We need to pick up, brothers and sisters, some of the spirit of adventure, casting ourselves upon God in faith that he'll be with us if, like the apostles, like Jehoiada and Jehosheba, we're trying to restore the truth at the time when everybody says, oh, it's too dangerous, or it's too difficult, or it's too late. Little Joash was hidden for 7 years before he came to the throne. And Jesus, the coming king of Israel, is hidden from sight now. Only a few of us know about his existence. But like Jehoiada, we have to prepare the hearts of the people to receive him and become his subjects. And the rulers of this present world, like Ataliah, whatever political party they belong to, are mostly interested in preserving their own status and their own wealth. And we know when Jesus comes, he will overthrow them. The revolution will take place all over the world, and he will be the king. And they will be dashed to pieces like a potter's vessel, actually, says Psalm 2, remember. And then, of course, the whole world will rejoice, just like the inhabitants of Jerusalem did on the day of Joash's crowning. The true worship of God will be restored at last all over the world, brothers and sisters. So as we eat the bread and drink the wine together now, we remember Jesus' promise that when he returns, he will gather his faithful followers to his side to be with him as his servants, as his ministers, when he sits on the throne of David forever. So let's remember him now in the bread and the wine.